Hello, I'm Patricia Camilleri. Welcome to today's programme in this series entitled The Artifact. In these programmes, I shall be speaking to some of Malta's key archaeologists about archaeology in general and about the many projects that are in progress or planned for the future. My guest today is Dr. Nicholas Vella. Dr. Vella holds a BA Honours degree in archaeology from this university and in 1999 gained his PhD from the University of Bristol in Phoenician archaeology. Following this, he received a scholarship for postdoctoral studies at the British School in Rome. He lectures at the University of Malta here, in Mediterranean history, archaeological method and theory, and of course, archaeology of the Phoenicians. His fieldwork includes the University of Malta's excavations in the multi-period site at Tassilj. And he's the author of many papers and other publications, one of which is the volume on Luigi Maria Ugolini, about which we shall be speaking today. Welcome, Dr. Vella. We could have spoken today about many different aspects of archaeology, but we've decided to focus on the recent discovery, or perhaps one could describe it as a rediscovery, by yourself and your friend and colleague, Andrea Pessina, of the Ugolini papers, his general collection. Perhaps you could fill us in a little bit on the narrative of the discovery. How did it happen?
Yeah, I was in Rome in 1998 on a scholarship at the British School at Rome. As some of our listeners might know, the British School has had in the past and still has today a link with Malta, because several of its directors had come over to Malta to conduct archaeological excavations. So it was with pleasure that I was spending 9 months in Rome undertaking research between 98 and 1999. At the time, I had an interest in looking at this historical link between Malta and the British School. And I did come across Luigi Maria Ugolini's published work, on Malta, and I was intrigued about his unpublished work. Luigi Ugolini died relatively young, as I will have occasion to say later, and his work was incomplete. I did embark on a search of his works when I was in Rome in 99, but unfortunately I did not manage to find any of his unpublished papers. It was only in 2000, when I had already started lecturing in Malta, that I was reading an article, and in a tiny footnote there was a mention of Ugolini's unpublished work, and the footnote said that the papers had been deposited in a museum in Rome, in a museum dedicated to prehistory, the Museo Nazionale Preistorico Etnografico Luigi Pigorini. That is the official name of the museum, which is outside the center of Rome. It's in Eur. And I phoned the museum director to ask whether the papers were still there. The publication that I had consulted was published in 1967. So, of course, anything could have happened between 1967 and the year 2000. And to my surprise, I received an answer in the affirmative, that the material was still there. And there were, I was told, more than 1,000 photographs and more than 15 or 16 box files full of Ugolini's papers.
Exciting.
So that was extremely excited. I did travel to Rome immediately afterwards to check and to see whether I could come into some sort of agreement with the Pigorini Museum so that research could be conducted on these papers. There I met the person who I've been working with over the last years, Andrea Pessina, who has now moved from Rome to Udine, where he works for the Archaeological Superintendency. And since then, we've been meeting regularly so that we can bring together this material for eventual publication.
And Luigi Maria Ugolini, who was this man? Where did he come from?
Yes, Ugolini, of course, was Italian. He was born in Bertinoro in Emilia-Romagna in 1895. on 8 September, and he seems to have had a very early interest in archaeology. Already at the Lyceum, he seems to have had an interest in archaeology, because there are records which relate to his interest in the paesaggio, in the landscape around his home, his hometown. He did study at the University of Bologna under figures who are important in Italian archaeology, like Gherardo Gherardini and the famous Etruscologist Pericle Ducati. And in fact, we know that his thesis was in fact on the prehistory of the Bertinoro area. He seems to have furthered his studies at the Scuola di Perfezionamento in Rome, which is what we would call the equivalent of a postgraduate degree. And we know that he also undertook several research trips in different parts of the Mediterranean. Apparently, we know that he joined the fascist party in 1923. And this this fact must have gone a long way into making sure that Ugolini formed part of the workings of the time, in other words, to get support for his research interests, not only in Italy, but abroad. Unfortunately, in the First World War, Luigi Ugolini, who had joined the Alpini Mountain Corps, had suffered, he received, in fact, a wound to his kidneys. And this is what led to his relatively young death in 1936 because of kidney failure.
It must have hit 41,
at the age of 41, yes. Mm-hmm. And that is why his work on Malta, but also on Albania, remained unfinished. I mention Albania because, despite the fact that Ugolini came to Malta for the first time in 1924, it was only in 1930 that he returned, and he came on regular visits for the following 5 years, between 1930 and 1935. His time before 1930 was taken up by excavations in Albania. Italy had an interest in Albania, and part of this interest entailed sending a team of archaeologists to explore the area. Why Albania, and more specifically, why Butrint, the site of Butrint? Because classical sources mention that Aeneas, on his way to Rome, stopped there. And of course, this lent a lot of weight to the fact that Albania and Italy were historically linked, and it justified the presence of the Italians there.
So it was perhaps for ideological reasons that the Fascist Party sent somebody like Ugolini to Butrint. And other excavations,
yes,
in Albania.
Undoubtedly.
But on the other hand, he was a good archaeologist. We're not just talking a party lackey here. You know, we're talking about somebody who was a career archaeologist in the most professional sense, I believe, from, at least from reading your book.
Yes, that is something which we have wondered about, and I say wondered about for the simple reason that in Malta, Luigi Ugolini did not carry out any archaeological excavations. So it is very difficult to assess his excavation skills. He was not allowed because he was Italian, and foreigners were not allowed to dig at the time, especially in the early 1930s, mm-hmm. when the political situation was such like mm-hmm. that the Italian presence in Malta was not particularly liked. However, we know that he undertook good excavations in Albania. The excavation records that we have for Butrint, which are being studied by another team, a joint Albanian and British team, shows that he knew what he was doing. In Malta, we do have notes that clearly show that he really had a good grasp on the methods of archaeological excavation. So even though he did not actually dig on the island, we knew that he could dissect what had been published pretty well, and he knew how to differentiate between good excavations and bad excavations. And in fact, some of his notes are not very complimentary towards particular key figures of Malta's archaeological scene.
Well, there are always differences of opinion in that area. One of the things that did impress me about him was his apparent ability to actually collaborate with other people. He had the idea of bringing in, he brought in Chesky for to examine the architecture. He brought in the painters. He knew how to look at something in a holistic manner. I believe.
Yes, correct, Trish. In fact, we always think of archaeological expeditions as being a one-person show. They are not, and in fact, they depend on a lot of collaboration, not only with the locals if it's a foreign mission, but also the fact that you have to bring with you other collaborators. And Dugolini brought with him to Malta in the early 30s, as you say, the architect Carlo Ceschi, and also an artist, a painter, by the name of Igino Epicocco, who was almost unknown before we started researching the work that Dugolini had done in Malta. In fact, you will find him in the revised edition of Nicholas de Piro's artists who painted Malta. Not just that, the fact that he brought over a team, but I think Ugolini will go down in the history of Maltese archaeology for the fact that he really managed to gel nicely with local scholars. And by local scholars here, I mean a whole retinue of people, including Sir Themistocles Zamit, including Sir Hannibal Scicluna, including Vincenzo Bonello, who at the time was curator of the fine arts section of the Valletta Museum, and a host of others. I think, and this was confirmed to us by a person who knew Luigi Ugolini, I'm referring to Berta Cassarto Reggiani, who we have interviewed on several occasions. She recalls that Luigi Ugolini had a fantastic charisma. And of course, that charisma, I think it's even visible from the photos. You get the sense that he was at ease with locals. Mm-hmm. I think this charisma got him to a lot of places, to visit a lot of sites, to enter into social circles in Malta, on which, of course, he depended. For example, we do know that even to enter Malta, it was not easy. And in fact, Themis Amit had to intervene on his behalf with the police commissioner so that he could enter Malta and be free from the usual restrictions that foreigners had. I think his personality was extremely, extremely important. Mm.
Just for those listeners who might only just have joined us, this is The Artifact, and I'm Patricia Camilleri, talking to Dr. Nicholas Vella, lecturer in the Department of Classics and Archaeology here at the University of Malta, and we're discussing the Ugolini collection. Just to go back to Ceschi for a moment, because I think that he homed in on a very interesting, much discussed, even to this day, idea of the roofing of the temples. It's interesting to note that he did a lot of work, obviously without the aid of computers at the time. But it's I think I'm right in saying that it seems as though he may have been right, or at least his ideas match up with the computer-aided design attempts that have been made recently.
Yes, correct. In his notes, Ugolini makes it very clear that during one of his early visits, I believe that in the 1930 or 1931, he required the assistance of an architect to be able to have a clearer idea of what these megalithic structures would have looked like in elevation. He had gone through the material in the Valletta Museum, even the models, the limestone models of the temples that Themis Amit had excavated in both in Imjar and in Tarshin. And these megalithic temples make these models make it very clear that what we have on our sides is just part of a much larger structure. But to be able to have this idea confirmed, he wanted an architect, and he brought with him Carlo Ceschi. Carlo Ceschi is a very important figure in Italian archaeology and art history. He was the author of an important treatise on architectural restoration and conservation, and I think it was very opportune for Ugolini to have Ceschi come over to Malta. And Ceschi published a book. Unfortunately, Ugolini never saw it because the book was published in 1939, where he clearly made reconstructions, very good reconstructions, of what these temples would have looked like in elevation and what the roofing would have been. And he suggested that the roofing would have been in large limestone slabs using the Globigerina limestone, in other words, Tal Franca, huge beams of such material. And this idea never went down well with other archaeologists. They could be right in the sense that we have never found in archaeological excavations, especially at Tarsien, any remains of such stone beams. But of course, it's very possible that these would have been taken away and smashed later on in time. But recent testing of this idea, using real beams and applying all sorts of tests in the laboratory of the Faculty of Architecture here at the university by a student called Konrad Schwierep, showed that what Ceschi was proposing is in fact technically feasible. Awesome. You can have a monument covered by roofed by such stone beams, which would not give way under their own weight. Mm-hmm. So this is a possibility. And in fact, therefore, Ceschi was not so mad after all to propose such a roofing system for our temples.
In the collection, you mentioned in the publication that there are about 1,000 negative slides. I'm not quite sure exactly how you describe them.
Glass negatives.
And in fact, he certainly was, Ugolini, a very talented photographer, without a doubt. Even the few ones that I've seen, obviously reproduced in the publication, you get an idea of his aesthetic sense.
Yes.
Definitely.
Yeah, very true. I think, again, we will have to list Ugolini amongst photographers who were active last century. His name never appears anywhere, but I think he should now be included. We always, when you have a look at a collection of photographs, you always have doubts whether all the photographs, or whether indeed any of the photographs, were taken by this person. You do have those doubts because the fact A, that Ugolini hardly ever appears in any of the photographs. Why? Because he was behind the camera. And of course, the notes confirm that he was the photographer. We have clear reference to such a thing. And not only that, but he was never happy to go on a site once, because of course the light would not have been adequate to capture some part of a temple rather than another. So he would return, but on the first occasion he would take note of the best times when to return on site. And this is clear from these hundreds and hundreds of papers which were in these box files when I had gone to the Pigorini Museum way back in the year 2000. We're still in the process of going through them, but I can assure you that the photographs are by him. There are photos which were sent by Temiz Ammit, and those have on the rear of the photograph a note saying that they were sent by Temiz Ammit, and even photos by Edward Gude, and they carry the stamp of Edward Gude. Edward Gude was another key figure in key photographers who worked before the war in Malta, and he worked very closely with Themistocles Ammit. So I think we should put these two figures together.
One of the chapters in the publication is entitled Nationalism and Archaeology in Malta. How can we put Ugolini really in an historical context within the Maltese situation?
Yeah, this is very interesting, and of course, my contribution here depends on when I say mine, I include also Andrea with me because we're working together. I think our contribution has to be seen in the context of all the research that has been conducted by historians, colleagues in the university here. I'm referring to both Dominic Fenech, Henry Frendo, and Joe Pirotta, in what they have been writing about events in Malta leading up to the Second World War. We know that there was a split between those who were in favour of Italy and those who were in favour of Britain. Of the crown on the island, and this, of course, this split goes back in time, way back to the Risorgimento, if we want to have a start off point. Ugolini came to Malta. He was sent here specifically in the 20s when pro Italian sentiment in Malta was growing, was on the increase. First, a character by the name of Roberto Paribeni came over to Malta, and in fact he published a book on the history of Malta, and the idea was to show Malta, the anima latina, the Italian soul of the island. That's why he came here. And it was Roberto Paribeni who pushed for an archaeological mission. Why an archaeological mission? Because if you want to show that the island was linked historically to Italy for centuries, but also for millennia, you needed archaeologists to prove that. And Ugolini was sent over, presumably first to study the classical heritage, the classical legacy of Malta, because that would have been an obvious link with Italy. We all know that Mussolini saw himself as the new Augustus, so the classical link would have been obvious. But in Malta, unfortunately, not much survives in terms of classical remains for that to have been sufficient proof for this connection. So what did he do? Ugolini, of course, was struck by the prehistoric remains. He realized how much work needed to be done on the interpretation of what had been found by almost a generation of archaeological activity in Malta. And essentially, what he came up with is the fact that already suggested by Temizamit, that the Maltese temples were very old, much older than the monuments of Minoan Crete, which Sir Arthur Evans had uncovered at the close of the 19th century. Why do I mention this? Because Minoan Crete would have been the precursor of classical antiquity. And of course, it would have been splendid to have a link with the classics through Minoan Crete. But Luigi Ugolini actually broke that link by saying that Malta was much older than Crete, and we did not need any cultural influence from the East, especially from Crete, to show how old Malta's civilization, civiltà, was. And this went down well with Ugolini, because the argument he put forth was that Malta's civiltà was the cradle of Mediterranean civilization, that it all started here. And it would have been splendid for Italy to recognize the fact that Mediterranean culture and civilization was all owed to Malta. What he was doing, what Ugolini was doing, without actually, I think, realizing, because we haven't found any reference to this in any of his notes, is supporting this idea of Malta's cradle of Mediterranean civilization, supporting a theory which went contrary and against to what Nazi archaeologists were saying. The idea at the time, led by Adolf Hitler and Himmler, who placed key archaeologists in universities in Germany, to prove that all civilization, especially in the Mediterranean, was owed to an Aryan culture, which came down from the north and conquered the Mediterranean. What Luigi Ugolini was saying, but unfortunately no one at the time picked on it, was to show that this, in fact, happened contrary to what Nazi archaeologists were saying. If you ask where Ugolini thought this culture in Malta came from, I think he suspected that it came from Africa, from Ethiopia. And we know that one of his planned visits had to be there. Of course, all this discourse, all this information which Ugolini was given about Malta as cradle of Mediterranean civilization was used by politicians and Enrico Mizzi and others to prove that Malta had a very important link, a very old link with the rest of Mediterranean, of the Mediterranean, but most especially with Italy.
So really, one might say that he came with an irredentist sort of ideology behind him.
Yes.
But in actual fact, he came up with ideas which are now proving to be extremely interesting.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, unfortunately, he died young in 1936, not publishing any of his works. But this is what he came up with.
Yes. Well, thank you very, very much, Dr. Nicholas Vella, for being with us today and to talking about the Ugolini collection. I do recommend the publication, Luigi Maria Ugolini, an Italian archaeologist in Malta, which is available in bookshops. The exhibition has come and gone, but the publication records it well and goes beyond it as well. Until next time we meet, this is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.